supporters of government-funded scientific research will gather at the steps of the state capitol tomorrow for the Stand Up for Science rally.
Rallies like this one are set to happen in all 50 states. In Wisconsin, organizers want to draw attention to the scientific work that's happening here as the Trump administration takes aggressive steps to halt federal dollars for many kinds of research.
Wisconsin rally organizer Maggie Stangus joins us. She is a senior PhD student studying cancer biology. Maggie, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here today.
You feel scientific research is under attack. Can you explain how?
Yes. So the biggest thing that's making us feel this way right now is that researchers as a whole, cancer researchers like myself and others, we don't know day by day whether our funding is going to be cut at any moment or if we're even going to be able to complete studies once we start them. So I really want to emphasize when we perform any sort of scientific study, these aren't things that are going to be necessarily completed within a week. We're talking something that could be going on for months at a time, up to even years. And so right now we're all afraid to even start a study up because we don't know if the funding is going to end.
Right. What happens when a research study is abruptly halted or interrupted before it's completed?
Yeah, it really depends on the specific study. You know, if a study has to end in the middle, it certainly can reduce how useful the data that's collected is. In the case of, talking again about cancer research, since that's my area, if it's a clinical trial, that could even lead to patients that are enrolled in that clinical trial not receiving life-saving treatment, especially if they're, you know, benefiting from the drugs in that trial.
So the NIH, National Institutes of Health, largest public funder of biomedical research in the world, Wisconsin receiving hundreds of millions of dollars in grant funding from NIH. Can you tell us about how that would be impacted, perhaps, even with your research?
Yes. So we know that Wisconsin's economic return from our research grants is massive. I don't remember the exact statistic, but I did look it up, and I think it's about $1.9 billion in economic impact from the research grants that come in from federal agencies like the NIH back to the state of Wisconsin. And so without that support, not only will research at a whole come to a standstill, but the state and the people of Wisconsin will be impacted as well.
You got involved with Stand Up for Science, this movement that you've seen quickly grow and grow and grow. But you've also had concerns about retaliation toward you and your employer. Can you talk about what is making scientists and researchers fearful right now?
I think, again, bringing it back to the funding concerns, it's we're concerned that our funding is going to be cut off at any moment. And really, for me, my biggest concern is again, the impact to the patients. Without that support from the federal government, we can't do our work and save lives at the end of the day. Without wide support for research, we can't go out there and help save lives. And if there's pushback on research for speaking out for how important it is, then that's going to stop us from helping to save lives as well.
This movement, Stand Up for Science, is asking lawmakers to, quote, end censorship and political interference with scientific research. What is that interference like?
So from my perspective, what we're seeing right now is an ask to avoid using certain words in our grant applications and publicly published papers describing results of research. And it's making it impossible for us to accurately represent the research. And accurate communication of our research results is important. It also benefits the public so that we can make sure that drugs are going to be safe and effective in a wide variety of patients when we administer them. And it makes sure that we can best represent our populations as a whole.
We've heard that scientists are having difficulty getting access to data, raw data. What can you tell us on that front?
Yes. So we have seen data sets that are publicly available, meaning, Kate, that you could go on the internet right now and look up, for example, CDC.gov or PubMed, for example, is another place where we have research papers available. And intermittently, those websites have been showing error 404 not found. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a tragedy both for the scientific community and for the American people as a whole, because that's not just our resource, that's the country's resource. That is data that belongs to everyone, and it should be available.
In our last moments together, how many people do you expect to turn out at the Capitol tomorrow, and what do you think the atmosphere will be like?
Yes, so tomorrow at the Capitol, just to emphasize again, we'll be there from 12 to 3. It's open to everyone that loves science and supports what we do. We're expecting up to 1,000 people to turn out, and we're just really hoping for an environment where we can encourage support from both sides of the table to return to supporting scientific funding.
And there will be speeches as well.
Yes.
At this rally.
Yes. Yeah. We have a really wonderful program that has been put together, and there's more information about that on our Eventbrite that can be found through the National Stand Up for Science website.
Maggie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, and I hope that everyone that's listening right now will give their support, support public radio as a resource as well.
That is Maggie Stangus, a doctoral candidate studying cancer biology. She's an organizer for the Stand Up for Science rally at the state capitol. It is set for noon tomorrow, and the nationwide rally aims to highlight the impacts of scientific research straight across the country.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a UW-Eau Claire program aims to cut back on food waste and provide meals to students who face food insecurity.
A lot of people struggle to be able to provide themselves with their own food, but especially nutritional food.
That conversation is just ahead here on WPR News.
In northwestern Wisconsin, a new program gives college students access to free and nutritious meals.
A UW-Eau Claire student launched that program last fall to provide leftovers to students facing food insecurity.
With the help of volunteers, the program will expand this spring and start notifying students when food is available.
Wisconsin Today producer Courtney Everett talked to UW-Eau Claire student Kristen O'Brien about her initiative.
You work in the Student Office of Sustainability. I want to start by talking about food insecurity on campus. What are you seeing at UW-Eau Claire?
Yeah, so a lot of people go into college kind of being responsible for their own funds for the first time in their life. And so I know with the people I've talked to and just people you see around campus, that adjustment is a big one. And so a lot of people struggle to be able to provide themselves with their own food, but especially nutritional food, either if it's a lack of knowledge of like how to cook for yourself and how to have access to those things, or just purely a lack of funds to have access to healthy and nutritional meals.
I'm glad you mentioned the visibility on campus. I had read that UW-Eau Claire students took a survey last spring measuring that they had some level of food insecurity. About 47% said so. With enrollment, that's about 4,000 students. So is that really visible on campus, this hunger need?
That's a good question. It's such a behind-the-scenes issue because so many people, when they think about college, they just assume that students have the resources that they need. You know, I know freshmen and sophomores are required to live on campus their first 2 years. And so that means that there are options of having a dining hall where you have food, but not all students have access to that. And even if they do, they might not have access to food over breaks or on weekends and stuff like that. And so it's something that is kind of stigmatized still on college campuses, but still kind of all over. And so the issue of food insecurity at our university is there, but you kind of have to search to find it. And then when you do, you kind of see how many students it impacts.
Speaking of access, I know there's the campus food pantry that provides non-perishable and perishable food items to students. I understand this has been around for more than a decade. You're a third-year student, so when did you realize that your fellow students experiencing hunger needed more support?
First of all, our food pantry, up until this academic year, was kind of in a building that not a lot of students went to, and so many students didn't even know that we had a food pantry on campus. And so in this academic year, when our food pantry was moved to Davies, which is our student hub, then all of a sudden people started talking about it a little more, being like, oh, I didn't realize that we had those resources. I would like to utilize them. And now that the food pantry is getting more visibility, it's a lot more accessible to students, there's a lot higher of a need to fill it with food.
I understand the Student Office of Sustainability and Dining Experiences has now a partnership to offer free meals to students. How did this develop?
Yes, that's a wonderful question. So it actually has been a year or two in the making. So fall 2023, me and a classmate had a meeting with a dining representative. We cater through Sodexo, and so we had a Sodexo representative as well as a few other administrators from our university. And at that meeting, we were able to kind of tell them the need we see for this on campus and give them examples of where else we have seen this. I have a friend that goes to the UW-Madison, and they told me about a similar system where food is repackaged from their dining halls and then given to students for free. And we really liked that idea. And so we brought that up at the meeting to see if there was some way that we could parallel that here to fit our university's needs. I actually left to study abroad shortly after that meeting. And then when I came back last summer, I got some email notifications saying, hey, after you had this meeting, this information and question continued to go to different systems at our school, and this is something that they want to work with us and do. And so that was amazing news. And so then we kind of got to get together again and start planning specifics about how we can implement this at our university in a efficient, successful way. And yeah, so dining, their cooperation with this has been instrumental. They are very careful to make sure that they're being safe with the leftover food and keeping it for us and making sure that it's not being thrown away before we have the chance to get there and package it.
So this food recovery program, you're repackaging food from the dining hall, giving it away to students, and you mentioned that food safety. How do you ensure that the food you are repackaging then is adequate for, you know, students that are going to pick it up?
Yes. So the food that we repackage is food that doesn't reach the hot plates of the buffet table. So that way we don't have fears about germs and maybe other students, you know, that sort of contamination that can happen. And so this is the food that doesn't get to that step. And so when we repackage it, we're careful to use, you know, proper serve safe methods with gloves and hairnets and washing hands, washing and using a clean surface, and then we actually freeze them. We don't have to worry about them going bad before students take them because they're just fly off the shelves essentially as soon as we fill them up. And then we put some allergen information on the stickers on the boxes just to make sure that anybody with allergies doesn't get one of these meals and then have an allergic reaction. So we make sure to say that it's cooked in a facility that uses gluten, wheat, shellfish, all of that jazz. And yeah, and then we have cooking instructions telling students to heat it to an internal temperature that correlates with the meal. And so far, we've had no food safety incidents. And so that's really exciting with this program.
We're talking about a student-led initiative at UW-Eau Claire that offers free meals to students facing food insecurity. Our guest is Student Director Kristen O'Brien of the Student Office of Sustainability. Kristen, you mentioned earlier the flying off the shelves with these meals. I understand even last fall, you nearly repackaged 600 meals for students. Are you able to package enough to then meet those demands? Are you finding enough volunteers?
Yes. So this is something where last semester was really kind of a trial semester, getting this started, making sure that we have a good system to do it. And now beginning this semester, we're starting to have a few more volunteers. Since last semester, it was me and a dining administrator, John. John. And so it was us repackaging these just by ourselves. And so now that we have a few more volunteers helping along, I think that will make a big difference. It is also a service learning activity at our university. So students can get credits towards a service learning requirement, which is really awesome for students.
Yeah, that's so neat. What type of time commitment does that entail?
Yeah, so essentially that will depend on how many volunteers we have in the future. As of right now, volunteers can expect to work 2 to 3 hours per week repackaging these meals. So not a whole lot.
I'm thinking then about the comfort level of students who may need this free and nutritious meal. Some may think, wow, this is a great free meal, while others may feel a little self-conscious about needing one. How do you create a welcoming environment for those students?
Yeah, so one amazing thing about our food pantry that we have on campus is that it is completely anonymous. The entrance, although now the food pantry is in a space that is visible to students, so it's very accessible, the entrance itself is kind of tucked away in a corner so people don't have to be afraid of everybody seeing them walking to the food pantry. But then you go in, you get your food, and as long as you show your student ID, that is essentially it. So there's no fear that your name will be let out to others and that other students not utilizing the food pantry will see you.
Have you noticed an improvement in student behavior or even academics since this launch last fall?
It is early to tell.
Okay.
With that, but I have spoken to students who have used it and they just love having full meals accessible to them in the food pantry that they can just take home, reheat, and eat. Because I think most of us are familiar with the science behind full bellies translates to better performance in the classroom, better moods for students, because it's really important to give your body the nutrition it needs. And so this free food helps give students access to that.
Another aspect of this program I want to talk about is launching this spring, the new alert system for students. Tell me how this system will work.
Yes, so I am so excited that we are doing this, and I hope that our university continues to do it for years in the future. And so essentially how it works is it is called Free Food Alert, and students are able to sign up online using their university emails. And then by signing up, they opt into receiving email and push notifications when there are catered events on campus that have leftover foods. And so they will be sent an email with what time the event is done, when students can come, what food is there. And so essentially it helps limit the food waste that often occurs after these catered events and also helps hungry students have access to that food.
Speaking of the food waste, are you yet aware of how much food waste you are, I guess, eliminating from going into the trash?
I don't have a specific number, but as you mentioned, we made about 600 meals last semester with the food packaging initiative. And all of those meals together, it's definitely, you know, hundreds of pounds worth of food that is not being thrown away, which it would have been otherwise if we hadn't repackaged it.
Before we go, how might another university adopt a program like this to support students then facing food insecurity?
Yeah, I think it is something where all you truly need is one student or administrator who's passionate about students' well-being to bring this up to other administrators and see how your university can make it work for you. Both of these programs, as I've told you, have been working with just a few people behind the scenes, essentially. Granted, it takes an entire network of people to make it work, but the week-to-week work that is done can be done by just a few people. And so I think that if you can get this as a volunteer opportunity, so students can see it as something that is very beneficial to them as well as other students, if you can enlist one person to kind of be in charge of these initiatives, then that really makes sure that it is going to be done in a productive, efficient, and successful way, and also ensure its longevity at the university.
Kristen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kristen O'Brien is a student director with the Student Office of Sustainability at UW-Eau Claire. She talked to Wisconsin Today producer Courtney Everett about the university's new program to ensure students have access to food.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, Portage High School won the state championship in curling, boys and girls. A coach and a player share their love of the sport.
I think my favorite part about the sport is the community. Just everyone loves to play, and it's not even always about playing. It's about having fun with the people you're with.
That's up next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin has a deep history with the sport of curling. The Wisconsin Historical Society says the city of Portage has one of the oldest curling clubs in the nation, starting in 1850.
And this year, Portage High School swept the state championships with wins for the boys and girls team, plus a championship mixed team representing the community.
The high school has a long history of big wins in curling. We're checking in now with the girls' championship team. Jim Schlimovitz has been the coach of that team, retiring after the latest season. And Sophia Brahm is a Portage High School student and member of the girls' state championship team. Sophia, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
And Jim, thanks for being with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Jim, let's start with you. Now, we got the championship for the girls and boys teams this year. This is nothing new. Portage is a powerhouse in curling. What is it that led the school to be such a competitor statewide?
Well, Portage curling has been around since the 1850s, but in the last 25 years, we really built up our junior program and excelled at that. I mean, we've had kids, we had just one kid play at the Olympic trials and she took third, and she was part of the high school team, Madison Bear. But we've been producing curlers for the last 20 years.
Sophia, what brought you onto the curling team?
I've curled since I was four. So wow. My neighbor when I was little, Laverne Griffin, got me into it, me and my brother. And I don't know, I've just been doing it ever since. Competitively and in high school.
Now, wait a minute, Sophia. I've never curled myself, but I look at the stone. That looks pretty heavy. Is there something lighter for the four-year-old to start with?
Yeah, there is, actually. I'm not sure what the weight is, but it's definitely less than half of what ours is.
And you started playing at four. What is it that you love about the sport that keeps you going, you know, from age four now into high school?
I think my favorite part about the sport is the community. Just everyone loves to play, and it's not even always about playing. It's about having fun with the people you're with.
Jim, people may have watched, you know, curling maybe in person or maybe when the Olympics roll around. What is it that you think people who have never played, you know, might not understand about the sport? Some of the skill and strategy that's going on that to the casual viewer they may not see.
Yeah, when you're watching a game just on TV, you'll see, oh, they'll throw a rock, then they'll throw another one. Well, it's not, it's the overall team dynamics. It's everybody thinking about the same shot, and it's thinking two or three shots ahead. It's like chess. You can't just think of the shot you're throwing. You have to think, okay, what's the other team going to do? Then what are we going to do? And how are we going to, you know, score our points in this game? So it's really a team communication, team dynamics.
So, Sophia, when you are out there, say, at a state championship, what kind of conversations are you and your teammates doing before before each round, maybe before each, what do you call it, a throw? Or what do you call
each
that?
Each end.
I'm sorry?
Each end.
So, yeah, what's going into that strategy and conversation with the team as you get ready for the next end?
A lot of it is just talking about how we're doing personally during the game, what we have seen about the ice, if there's any spots that are picking or like would, so the rock would go the wrong way, or things that we're noticing about the ice or the other team.
Now, Jim, you mentioned 20 some years of serious high school history, but the tradition of curling in Portage goes way before that. Can you talk about the origins of why Portage is such a curling town?
I don't know why it's just always been a curling town. I started here back in 1992, where a friend of mine just pulled me out and said, let's go curl. And I fell in love with it. The strategy, the throwing, the dynamics, and then meeting people. And I think it was a big, back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, listening to some of these younger, older people in the mine. And they just talked about the friendship they developed throughout the state and throughout the country. I was just playing this weekend up in Wisconsin Rapids, and I knew almost everybody up there from either playing high school or just playing other events with them. So it's a real big community feeling.
Sophia, do you feel that as part of the team and I guess as clubs over the years, that feeling of community?
100%. Like, when I look at all the teams throughout state, like if I've seen them in competitive curling, I know them and I've talked to them. I've had really good conversations with people.
And do you see, Sophia, something that this is something you're going to do, you know, even after you're out of high school, you're going to keep playing?
Yes, I already have plans to play, not to play competitively in college, but to play in a club.
We're talking about the sport of curling at the high school level and beyond. Sophia Brahm is with us, high school student, curling state champion with the Portage High School girls curling team, and Jim Schlimovitz, coach of that girls curling team. Jim, what brought you into coaching at the high school level?
Well, the other girls coach had retired after so many years, and I was curling with the boys coach. And he said, why don't you come over and just coach? And I started that in 2010, kind of not knowing much about curling. You know, I've curled for 10 years or a little longer at that time, but I really didn't know the nuances of it. And I picked it up over the last 10 years and just loving it. So I started in 2010 with the help of Rusty Shriver, who used to be the Paralympic coach for Team USA, and he taught me a lot about it. And then going to camps and just learning different strategies from our elite curlers and our elite coaches, you know, and it's just dwarfed into something really special.
And Jim, what is the balance between people like Sophia, who've played since age 4, versus maybe that high school student who's trying the sport out for the first time? Do you have some of both on your team?
Yes, we do. We got the curlers that are pretty advanced, and then we got new curlers. So trying to bring the new curlers in to make them able to play in full games. We have one girl this year who, this was her first year out. And at state, Portage always takes two teams to state, our first team and our second team. She was able to play because she picked up the game and learned it. And that, you know, just seeing her develop like that is what makes coaching fun.
Sophia, I got to say, whenever I've talked to people who do curling, they really love introducing the sport to new people. Do you feel that? Do you enjoy that opportunity to take maybe a teammate who's never picked up a rock before and help them learn the game?
I actually love doing it. And one of the girls that was on my team at State, Olivia Goldthorpe, she started freshman year. And it was so fun watching her learn, and like she would just excel at it insanely. And even in our gym, we have curling during our gym classes too, and a lot of us go over and help teach the people, and it's so fun.
Jim, what are the facilities at Portage High School? Do you have your own setup, or do you have to go to a club to train? What do you have to work with there?
Yeah, so in the state of Wisconsin, I believe there's between 20 and 25 curling clubs. And in Columbia County is the most. We have 13 sheets of ice in the county, and that's the most in the United States. So we take the kids over from the high school over to the curling club and practice 3 to 4 days a week, from 3:30 to 5:30. And with this, we've increased our membership at the curling club from either the parents that of the kids who are curling or the former students by about 20 to 30 members. And our Portage Curling Club is wonderful to work with. They don't charge us anything. They let us have the ice and really support the high school.
Now, Sophia, I want to have you take us to the state tournament here. You've been playing again since you were four. Probably some events are more casual. This one, though, is serious. It's the state championship. Do you feel extra mental pressure? How do you cope with the higher stakes there?
I personally definitely felt the pressure just since I throw our last rock on our team. And our team really tries to keep it calm because we all know that we play better when we're having a good time or having fun. So we just try and keep it lighthearted. That's really how we do well.
And Jim, I understand this was your last year as coach. You're retiring from the position, going out, of course, on a big win. So congratulations on that. As you leave, what are your hopes for the future of the curling program at Portage High School?
Well, going back over the last 16 years, I put some, stats together that, we've had 307 wins, only 40 losses. And I'm hoping, and kids that have excelled up to the college nationals, U.S. nationals, U.S. Olympic trials. We also have a couple kids competing overseas with the Philippine national team. So I'm hoping this program continues to grow, continues to develop. Myself left it in a good place that we can really get more kids involved in the sport, more publicity for the sport, and more fun for the kids.
And Sophia, what would you say maybe to younger people listening, maybe somebody just going up into high school in Portage or elsewhere, to try to get them to give curling a try?
I would just say grab a friend, go out and try it, because you never know how much fun it is until you try it with a group of people you know or don't know. It's really just about the community. And once you start meeting people, it just gets more fun from there.
And we'll leave it there. Sophia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Jim, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Sophia Brahm is a Portage High School student and curling state champion. Jim Schlimovitz is a former coach for the Portage High School girls curling team, just retired after the last season. The team won the state championship last month. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.